When the folks from the IC called me some months ago, they had asked me initially to talk about, and here was the topic, it's on the program, making abortion unthinkable. Now, as probably most, if maybe all of you know, that's the name of a very helpful five-session curriculum. It's put out by our evangelical friends at Stand to Reason. And as it turns out, next Saturday I'll be doing that material in St. Louis, on the St. Louis campus. So if you're from St. Louis and you'd like to experience that, please join us. All that stuff is on the website. And it's really good stuff, actually. It's very calm. It's very reasonable. Apologetics uses basic science, moral reasoning. But when they asked me to do that, I hesitated for obvious reasons. The Making Abortion Unthinkable material is five sessions of an hour or more each. And we have 45 minutes, or actually, as I just promised, a little less. Now, the stuff is really helpful. I mean, it really helps clarify our own thinking. It helps us to offer reasonable responses to what the other side sometimes says. So I just thought I'd give you a couple of examples to whet your appetite. So for instance, sometimes, this is one of my favorites, sometimes you hear, oh, the fetus is just a blob of cells. Now, there's a number of ways to respond to this, but of course, my favorite is, well, so are you. Now, here's another one. It's a little more substantial takeaway from this material. It's a tactic, and some of you, again, maybe all of you know it. It's called trotting out the toddler. And it's a way of clarifying, actually, what the real question actually is when it comes to abortion. And it works like this. So somebody brings up a situation in which they think that abortion is justifiable or acceptable. So you take that situation and you pull the unborn child out of it and you put a two-year-old into the situation and then ask whether killing the two-year-old would be justifiable. So, for example, well, the mother lives in abject poverty and won't be able to afford to care for the unborn child. So I might respond, by the way, this is always a good way to go. Can I ask you a question? I mean, you actually ask their permission, right? See? And they say yes, and you say, well, do you think it would be justifiable for this mother in her terrible poverty to kill a two-year-old toddler whom she couldn't afford to care for? The answer, of course, will be almost certainly no. And then you ask the question, why? And the response will have to be, because it's a child. And then we say, that's the question. That's the question. And so this tactic brings the conversation back around to what is really the central and most important question, really the only question of all, what is the unborn? So, again, the Making Abortion Unthinkable curriculum is really helpful. Again, it's calm, it's logical, it's really very superbly done. By the way, you can buy it on the Stand to Reason website. It's www.str.org, and it costs $50. See? And now you have this as a resource for your congregation. The talking heads in the videos are Greg Kokel and Scott Klusendorf. You guys know those names. And they do all the heavy lifting. So it's really easy to use. And I would actually highly recommend it to you. I think I've led it at the seminary campus about 8 or 10 times. So. But my topic was making abortion unthinkable, right? And it's 5 hours, and so I had two choices. I could talk really fast, or I could try to do something a little different. And some foolish person at the IC said I could do whatever I wanted. So that's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna try something a little different. So, and here's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna try to make one point. I'm gonna do some teaching on one point. And then I'm gonna fill in a blank in a different way than we actually have been doing at this conference as we all head back to our homes and our churches. Now, I'll tell you now what that blank is that I want to fill in a different way, and then I'll come back to it. But here's the blank. Making abortion unthinkable for whom? So So just keep that in your brain. We'll come back to it. That's the blank I want to fill in toward the latter part of my presentation. But the first point I want to make is this. And I'm going to actually fix a mistake that does occur in the Making Abortion Unthinkable curriculum. Now again, you all know, most of you know Greg Kochel. He's a terrific gift to the life-affirming movement. But he's talking in there about the sorts of objections that abortion supporters throw at us. And he mentions this one. You may have heard it. Well, you pro-life people don't care about women. Now his response is this. Even if that were true, what does my character have to do with the validity of my argument? Now, on one level, he's right. You can be a really nasty person and think clearly. Now, Kochel goes on, of course, to say that life-affirming people do care about women, and of course, there's lots of evidence for that. But I want you to think with me on a deeper level about what he said. Even if I don't care about women, what does my character have to do with the validity of my argument? He sort of implies that the answer is not much. But this is deeply wrong. Because persuasion and truth don't just happen in the brain. They happen in the heart. And now I know he didn't really mean this, and Greg Kochel is a smart guy. But if it were to turn out to be true that life-affirming people had compassion only for some and were people who were angry and unreliable or even violent, then this would completely destroy any attempt to persuade anyone or to make abortion unthinkable. Because character matters. The character of the person making the argument always matters. If I am standing for truth, who I am counts. Listen, for instance, to 1 Peter chapter 2. Beloved, I urge you, as sojourners and exiles, to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your life. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Now, what's going on for the people to whom Peter writes is not unlike what's going on for us today. For them, it's not real persecution, not yet. I mean, we sometimes overread the New Testament. The persecution hasn't become systematic or even violent except for a sporadic outbreak here or there. If you read 1 Peter carefully and study the history, the believers are facing difficulty, but it's more informal. It's kind of personal pressure. There's a pressure to conform to the world. And when they don't conform, then more pressure comes. So the Christians are being taken advantage of. They're being treated unfairly. They're being called names. I hope that sounds somewhat familiar to you. But their conduct is to be so honorable that their good deeds are evident. So what does our character have to do with the persuasiveness of our argument? A lot. This is why, for instance, the Apostle Paul says that overseers or pastors are to be above reproach. Because if I'm not, then my character can bring a stain and a dishonor and a discredit onto the gospel. And I can actually hinder the truth from being heard. So to Titus, Paul writes, it's from Titus 2, show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works, and in your teaching show integrity, dignity, sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. Character matters. Just last Sunday, it was a very joyful day. I preached at the ordination of one of our students. And the final question in the ordination rite says something like this. Will you adorn the gospel with a holy life? I remember that question from June the 10th, 1979. It was the most frightening question of all. But the answer must be yes. Yes, I will. God helping me. God helping me by the grace and power of His Holy Spirit. Now, we all know of modern examples of stories that show how much character matters. Someone's heart first begins to be softened, not by words of truth or clear-headed logic, as important as those things are, but by compassion, by the greatest virtue of all that Jesus Himself embodied, love, even for our enemies. Abby Johnson comes to mind. And many of you will have read her book, Unplanned, which is a terrific book. And it tells precisely this story. The people on the other side of the issue cared as much about women or even more than she did. And even more surprisingly, they cared about her, even when she was their enemy. Well, sisters and brothers, so it is with all of us who want to affirm all of life, and especially the lives of unborn children. Our character matters if we are going to persuade anyone. Now, I understand that only God can change a heart, but you'll understand what I'm saying now. We're not supposed to make God's job harder. Now, I want to think with you for just a minute this morning, especially about the danger and the damage that anger can do. When that anger is flowing out of a person who is trying to offer God's truth about life in the public sphere. Now, I understand that there's a lot to be angry about, but anger is not the way of Christ. Now, I know that anger in and of itself is just an emotion. It's not right or wrong, but anger is, as we all know, a particularly violent emotion. And in a heartbeat, it becomes sin. I also realize that our Lord Jesus became angry, and so anger can't be automatically wrong because Jesus had no sin. I get that. By the way, angry, life-affirming people like to bring that up to me. My response, by the way, and it sounds glib, but I mean it, is, you're not Jesus. Come back to me when you're Jesus. Right? And by the way, if you're not convinced by this much, I'd invite you to do a study of anger in the New Testament. It's really quite striking. It's really the closest thing you can find to a positive statement is this: be angry, but don't sin. Oh, that's a real ringing endorsement. See, to be honest, I've been so influenced by James chapter 1. Know this, my beloved brothers and sisters, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. For the anger of man does not work the righteousness of God. James sounds a lot like his older brother, doesn't he? I think Romans 12 is really key here. Just listen to what St. Paul says. Bless those who bless you, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep, live in harmony with one another. Don't be haughty, associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If it's possible, I like that. If it's possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, "Vengeance is mine. I will repay," says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink, for by so doing you will heap burning coals on his head. I don't quite know what that means. Don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So let me let you in on a little secret. I'm talking about anger in the hearts of life-affirming people because I am a person like that. I can feel the anger. I can feel the desire to punish and to avenge. And that lives in me. It's not right. Somebody should give them what they deserve. Well, the response to this is multiple, of course. But at the very least, if it comes to that, then God takes care of that. And only God. Now, the general point I'm making is this. Our character matters in presenting the truth about life, about unborn life. You know, this old dead Greek guy, Aristotle, see, he understood this. He understood how you persuaded people. We know it's all true. He said that the three elements of good persuasion are reason, or logic, logos. We're good at that, I think. And then there is pathos, which is feeling, a shared feeling between the person speaking and the person listening. A shared humanity. And the third one is ethos, which is the character of the speaker. And whether I'm living and moving in the church or in the public sphere, whether I'm carrying out my vocation under God's right hand or his left, Jesus still is the Lord. He is the only Lord, and I am his disciple. So this is my first point, to consider if we want to make abortion unthinkable, our character matters. And as those who value and affirm the value of all human life, our character is to be good, compassionate, strong and true, life-giving, life-affirming, humble and gracious. Now, my second point, I mentioned it a minute ago, is this, and here's why I want to fill in that blank after making abortion unthinkable in a particular way, and it's going to take us actually, to be honest, in a different direction from most of the conference. Now, what I'm about to say is my own opinion, although I don't think it's my opinion only. So I could be wrong, and actually I'd be very happy if I were wrong. And I do believe, by the way, that we are to impact the culture. I think it's an amazing idea to restore our LCMS presence here, for instance, in Washington, D.C. I mean, we used to have an office here. One of my colleagues, David Adams, I think was the director of that office. So I think that's terrific. It's all good, see. But I think there's a task that is closer to home. And what I fear is that we are not making abortion unthinkable for the church. Not thinking now about the culture around us, or the places of political power, but in the church. And here's what I mean. I suspect that the vast majority of our Missouri Synod congregations and her pastors could be described as life-affirming. I really believe that. They hold to the truth about lots of life issues, maybe all of them. Chief among them, of course, is abortion. Now, I will say that I have heard stories from returning vicars over the years at our seminary where their supervising pastor actually showed himself to be in favor of abortion as an option for women and men. By the way, when Glenn Nielsen finds out about that, our vicarage director, then those congregations don't get a vicar again. So at the very least, we can be happy that this is very rare and it hardly ever happens. But you see, it's one thing to be life-affirming, pro-life, if you will, and to observe Life Sunday, probably tomorrow, maybe last Sunday, once a year. It's another thing, however, to live and carry out a congregation's life in a broad and compassionate way that affirms and actually equips God's people to affirm the value of all human life. Now, I include myself in this problem, to be honest. Now, I was pro-life, you know, back in the 80s, before, dang, most of you people were born, right? By the way, I'm one of those old people that's going to die so you guys can take over the leadership. Is that what you said, Laura? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, okay. Good. I really appreciate you saying that. But I'll tell you this. I've been an ordained pastor for 35 years. For the first time in my ministry, first as a parish pastor, then as a theologian who is an active member of a congregation and who teaches a Bible class, for the first time, this past fall, I actually set myself to teach a course dedicated to a calm and careful look at basic truths about human life. I'm a little embarrassed to say it, but there it is. Now, these things come up and you talk about them. They come up fairly often, right? But to really focus and to work carefully to make abortion unthinkable in the church. And so my Bible class at our home church spent 11 weeks pondering basic Christian truth. Now, I deliberately cordoned off every single political discussion, and boy, did they want to go there, right? But I was mean, and I didn't let them, because we needed to do first things first. So, as I like to say these days, we didn't bring up either the donkey people or the elephant people. Not in this class, because neither the donkey party nor the elephant party are Christians. Although there are Christians in the parties, to be sure. But as the last speaker at the rally said on Thursday, Uncle Sam may be my uncle, but he is not my father. And I would add that he is not the Lord. Christian and political party don't really go together all that well, just like oil and water. So in this class, we focused on three basic truths, and we actually came back to them every single week, every week. The first truth is that life is a gift from God, but a gift over which God retains ownership. I compared it to the promised land for Israel. The land was a gift. It was their inheritance. The Bible calls it their possession, but it always and ever still belonged to God. And they were to live in the land as a manifestation of their relationship with God. So it is with life, God's gift, but always and ever God's possession. We may not do with life what we wish. The second truth was that because of Jesus, his incarnation, his death, and especially his resurrection, all human life is valuable. Now, you could talk about the image of God if you like, that's fine, but if Jesus is at the center of the Bible, and to be honest, Jesus is the image of the invisible God, and we are being remade into the image of Christ, then I'd rather root our value and the value of every human life in the one who became a man for us and who rose from the dead to immortal life for us and for all people. Because of Jesus, all human life is valuable. The third truth was this: if life is God's gift and constant possession, and if all human life is valuable because of Jesus, then our response to life and to the needs of other lives is to love them. Our response to the value of human life is to love. Love for others, even for our enemies, as Jesus taught. So in light then of these three basic truths, we looked at suicide, we looked at abortion, including the hard cases. We then came back and looked at physician-assisted suicide. We actually used Maggie Carner's moving video, you know, in response to Bethany Maynard, and so forth. We also looked at Bethany Maynard, right? So we looked at things. And to be honest, those of you that know Renee, she's the optimist, I'm the pessimist. So it went better than I thought it was going to go. Now, on some of the issues, people were right there with me, just no questions. On others, they looked at me like I was nuts. See? I could see them thinking. I could see their thinking changing. Now, I'd be lying to you if I told you that everybody in the class ended up at the end where I wanted them to be. I didn't expect that. See? But I just decided it was high time, way past time, for me to do something about making abortion unthinkable in the church. And so I taught a class. Imagine that. Now, you know at least as well as I do what the culture is doing to the church: drumming, repeating, persuading, tempting, convincing. It is actually relentless. It is subtle, it's obvious, it's happening all of the time. Now, please don't misunderstand me when I say what I'm about to say. You can't counter that with the divine service alone. You can't. See, the divine service is for absolution and forgiveness and making the dead alive again. But we have to teach. We have to equip God's people. And you heard Lila Rose exhort us yesterday about our congregations needing to be as committed to having a life-affirming ministry as we are to having a mission or educational ministry. The church is being taught by the culture. And so we have to teach back. As my pastor likes to say, we have to teach the devil to death and prepare and equip. Now, I might be wrong, and you might disagree with me. By the way, if you disagree with me, I promise not to be angry about it. But I think that we need to be thinking about how in the world, under God's blessing, how can we more actively counter the world's influence in the church? We have the what. I think we've got the what. See, the question is how. I have a very specific suggestion for you, for pastors, for lay people, students, everybody. It's a suggestion that comes out of the last couple of years of our experience on the campus of Concordia Seminary. My specific suggestion for you is get yourself a life team. Have you got one of these postcards? They've been planted. My spies from Lutheran High planted them on your seats. No, I'm quite serious. I mean, there's a button on the Lutherans for Life website that looks just like that. See? If you go to www.lutheransforlife.org, spell it out, and you find this button and you click, and you'll see a 2.5 minute video that will get you started learning about what a life team actually is and can be. Now, again, I mean something specific by this. I don't mean a life group or a committee, I mean a life team. Let me tell you our story at St. Louis a little bit. See, for years and years, we had a pro-life group at the St. Louis Seminary. The energy from the group mostly came from my wife, right? I helped, or as they say in Texas, I hepped. But almost every year, we would get tired, and then she would want to do more, and I would want to do less. And so I think usually in mid-September and in mid-January, we'd have a fight. Right, dear? Yeah, right. See, shall we do more or shall we do less? And of course, the right answer was less, and her answer was more. But so. Yeah, it was really funny. And so students would be there to help. For instance, Jeff and Melissa came to the seminary, and they had all kinds of life-affirming experience. And so those are some great years. I think of them as the Duncan years, okay? See, but then students come and they don't have the experience. And so what do you do? I mean, it's up and down, back and forth, and you're getting tired. And see, if you can believe this, those of you that know my beautiful wife, even Renee was getting tired. and I certainly was too. Now here's the turning point in the story. Enter Churches for Life and the Reverend Douglas Murky. Now, if you haven't met him, Doug is a conservative Presbyterian pastor. He's PCA, and he's the founder and CEO of Churches for Life. Doug has actually developed a model. It's a specific model for life-affirming congregational ministry. We're using it at the seminary with his considerable help and wisdom, and we've been using it for 5 years. The model is called a life team. We have a mission statement. It runs like this. Centered in the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Concordia Seminary Life Team equips our seminary community and others to affirm life. And here's some of the things we've done. Prayer at Planned Parenthood, ministry in the aftermath of miscarriage, caring for post-abortive women and men, ministry to and with the elderly, options for adoption, reclaiming a Christian understanding of what it means to be a godly single adult, and support for parents who have chosen not to abort their children. Now, here's the deal. I didn't come up with that. Renee didn't come up with that. The team came up with it. And so I would just like to encourage you. I thought, well, they told me I could talk about whatever I wanted to, so this is what I'm talking about. Because it's been so encouraging and helpful. Now, you pastors who already have too much to do, To you, I want to say the Life Team is lay-led. The leadership is chosen carefully, and they receive training, right? In our setting, I kind of function as the pastor, right? And the students are the lay people, so to speak. Most importantly, a Life Team is centered in the gospel. Everything it does flows out of the gospel. Everything it does is motivated by the gospel. There are 9 characteristics of a Life Team. I can't emphasize enough that this is a particular model of ministry. And I'm encouraging you to learn about this model, how it's built and how it's worked. I mentioned the first facet, that is the gospel. Gospel motivated, gospel driven. That's the most important thing. Now, I'm not going to go over the list. You can watch the video of the other 8 characteristics. Again, Lutheran's Life has adopted the model, right? They're adapting it and using it. They have a staff person, Laurie Trinchy, who's her work is focused on helping congregations. At the present time, there are more than 70 Missouri Synod congregations who are in various stages of developing a Life Team. And there's videos on the website, testimonies from LCMS pastors and lay people about this. But let me just emphasize 3 of the values. First of all, a Life Team is trained to be trusted by the congregation. Trusted, especially by the pastor. Especially by the pastor and the other leaders. Nothing happens without the pastor's knowledge and blessing. Second, a Life Team is careful. We all know that we need to be careful because people freak out. People think, oh, here come those crazy pro-life people again. No, we're going to be careful in how we advance life-affirming ministry in our congregation. And third, a Life Team is trained to be multifaceted. Now, for the last couple days, we've been focusing on the biggest issue, right? Abortion, right? But there are so many other forms of life-affirming work that a congregation can do. Life Teams are open and searching for ways to serve and teach and to equip. One of the things we like to say is, well, look, God is already at work, right? Yeah, he's not waiting for us to do things. So God's at work, so let's just try to figure out what he's doing, and we'll go over and join him there. And that's going to vary from congregation to congregation, from context to context. It's a beautiful model. Okay, it's about time to stop. I said I would end early, and so I will, but I want to share with you what I kept thinking over and over during the march on Thursday. And by the way, this is for me also the first time to attend the event. Here's what kept going through my head. I am here as a citizen, along with other citizens. I am here as a citizen. But why am I here? The answer is Jesus. I'm here because of Jesus. And that is true for me in every direction. You see, I'm here with you, my sisters and brothers, because of Jesus. Because Jesus claimed me on April the 20th, 1952. And he's never let me go. I simply can't tell you the number of times that I've tried to let go of him. But he wouldn't have it. And so I'm here with you, my family, because of Jesus. And we've stood and acted and spoken on behalf of the unborn because of Jesus. And now we're going to go home, and we're going to live and move and have our being there because of Jesus. Because when all is said and done, that's all that matters. Thanks a lot.